disproportionate effect of COVID-19. Instead of responding to the legitimate outcries based on the murders of Rayshard Brooks and Ahmaud Arbery, that she has instead decided to harass Black Lives Matter activists. But what's more important is that the WNBA is living out their history and their legacy of activism. They are speaking their truth because they know it actually matters. 2016 was one of those elections where we knew the consequences would be grave, but no one expected it to be this dystopian nightmare that we've been embedded in. And we know that now is the time to use our power to win. And I'm so proud of those WNBA players. I'm proud of being part of the legacy of John Lewis, that across the state of Georgia, we are doing our part to win the state and to win the future by saying that you will not steal our power and steal our voices in this election.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Thank you, baby. I just wanna take a little time out to you. Thank you, baby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for contributing to KBOO's membership drive. It was a success, and we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click. Summation needs a TTT. Thank you for your love, for your care, for your kind.
From the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, vote counting in several key states continued late Thursday night into Friday morning, leaving the results of the November 3rd presidential race up in the air for the third day in a row. In the middle of the night, votes that had been cast in the Democratic strongholds of Philadelphia and Atlanta flipped President Donald Trump's lead in Pennsylvania and Georgia, respectively, giving Joe Biden the edge. Those densely populated cities where communities of color organized massive voter registration efforts had large backlogs of votes to count and turned the tide against Trump, as many had predicted. Georgia's Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger announced, quote, "With a margin that small, there will be a recount in Georgia. Interest in our election obviously goes far beyond Georgia's border. The final tally in Georgia at this point has huge implications for the entire country," end of quote. Georgia's state legislature is dominated by Republicans. In Arizona, where Biden took an early lead, the race appears to be tightening, but the Democratic nominee still maintains his lead. Many blame Republican state lawmakers for this week's vote counting delays in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, where it was known that densely populated districts that leaned heavily Democratic would vote early and/or by mail. Lawmakers in those states insisted that there could be no counting of votes until Election Day, thereby setting up nail-biting finishes, where President Donald Trump could cast doubts on vote tallies and challenge results in court. Trump has lost challenges in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Georgia, and Nevada. On Thursday late afternoon, Trump gave a low-energy press briefing at the White House, where he spewed so many lies that most networks simply cut away from carrying it live. He began by saying, quote, "If you count the legal votes, I easily win. If you count the illegal votes, they can try to steal the election from us." Later on Twitter, where the social media platform has flagged most of his posts, Trump said out loud that he had what he had planned for weeks, that the Supreme Court should intervene in the election. Those Trump lawyers that are now petitioning the court apparently have ties to Trump-appointed Justice Brett Kavanaugh through the Federalist Society. The one legal victory that the Trump campaign can claim is a judge's recent ruling to overturn COVID-19 social distancing rules in Pennsylvania and allow election observers from both parties to watch vote counting from up close. But Trump allies in the U.S. Senate are now jumping on the bandwagon of trying to delegitimize the election in Pennsylvania, saying election observers were not allowed. Fox News host Sean Hannity spoke with Republican Senators Lindsey Graham and Ted Cruz and discussed invalidating Pennsylvania's election.
Should these Republican lawmakers in Pennsylvania and elsewhere, if there's corruption in the law, they don't abide by the law and they don't allow observers in as the law calls for, should they then invalidate this?
I think everything should be on the table. So there's the process of observing an election that's being violated. Philadelphia elections are crooked as a snake. Why are they shutting people out? Because they don't want people to see what they're doing.
But in a state that can prove that the law was violated and observers were kept away, which is their right, which is the law, do you have a revote?
You know, that is a tough question. I can tell you in election law litigation, the standard for holding a new election is extraordinarily high. Courts try to do everything else before they do that. But, you know, I am more than a little frustrated that every time they close the doors and shut out the lights, they always find more Democratic votes.
That's Senator Ted Cruz, and before him, Lindsey Graham, saying that Pennsylvania's election needed a do-over because their president was losing. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy went even further, saying simply, President Trump won this election. In Nevada, where a slow vote count has inspired thousands of online memes, the state Republican Party sent the Justice Department a criminal complaint about allegations of thousands of cases of voter fraud. The Nevada GOP posted on Twitter, quote, "Our lawyers just sent a criminal referral to AG Barr regarding at least 3,062 instances of voter fraud. We expect that number to grow substantially. Thousands of individuals have been identified who appear to have violated the law by casting ballots after they moved from Nevada." In Michigan, Republican Senate candidate John James is now reportedly refusing to concede to Democratic incumbent Senator Gary Peters after news outlets projected Peters as winning re-election. James released a statement calling for an investigation into Michigan's election, saying, quote, "I have deep concerns that millions of Michiganders may have been disenfranchised by a dishonest few who cheat." It is not clear what sort of disenfranchisement James was referring to. Philadelphia police on Thursday night arrested two men on firearms charges after receiving a tip that they may have planned an attack on the convention center where vote counting is taking place. Tensions are high around the nation as Trump has mobilized his army of armed supporters, calling on them to fight back against his legitimate loss. Facebook and Twitter are scrambling to stop the massive spread of violent rhetoric online. Facebook removed a group called Stop the Steal, which echoed the slogan promoted by a network of far-right and Republican-linked and funded groups to engineer a win for Trump. According to Reuters, the Stop the Steal Facebook group was adding 1,000 new members every 10 seconds and had grown to 365,000 members in a day. A Facebook spokesperson said, quote, "The group was organized around the delegitimization of the election process, and we saw worrying calls for violence from some members." Small groups of protesters have been rallying outside vote counting centers in key states all over the country. Meanwhile, Twitter permanently banned former White House advisor Steve Bannon for calling for the beheading of two government officials that he perceives are working against Trump's interests, Dr. Anthony Fauci and FBI Director Christopher Wray. The U.S. Postal Service, which is being run by a Trump loyalist, Louis DeJoy, has been ordered to comply with a federal judge's ruling to search for remaining mail-in ballots. The USPS refused to comply with the judge's deadline of election day to locate hundreds of thousands of missing ballots and deliver them on time, thereby jeopardizing many of those votes. The Postal Service delivered about 40,000 ballots on Thursday and announced on Friday that an additional 1,076 were found at a mail processing center in Philadelphia. And finally, U.S. cases of coronavirus infections rose for a second day in a row to more than 120,000 in a 24-hour period. That's a new record. States are now imposing restrictions once more in response. And that does it for our news headlines. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As vote counting went late into the night on Thursday for the presidential race, I spoke with two activists in Pennsylvania and Georgia, where the nation's focus was as votes for Joe Biden began turning those red states blue. Anna Dennis is the executive director of Common Cause Georgia, and Nicholas O'Rourke from Philadelphia is a pastor, former city council candidate, and Pennsylvania organizing director of the Working Families Party. Welcome to the program, all.
Thank you.
Nicholas, let me start with you. You are in Philadelphia. You are outdoors right now. You have been outdoors for a while, and we want to get a report from you before your phone battery dies. Tell me what you've been doing in Philadelphia, and why is it taking so long for Pennsylvania's votes to be counted?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on tonight. Yes, it is true, as you can probably see and hear, I am outside. We are standing outside of the Pennsylvania Convention Center at 11th to 12th and Arch. Where the votes currently are still being tabulated inside. There's many of us who are dancing with joy in our hearts, which is an expression of resistance to the counter protesters that are trying to stop the vote count here in Philadelphia. But the reason why these many Trump supporters and supporters of the president are out trying to stop the vote count is really interesting to us, because the reason why it's taking so long is because Republicans actually stopped any efforts to have early voting. Early counting or tabulation of those votes prior to Election Day. We knew heading into this global pandemic that it was going to have a major effect on the electoral process in Philadelphia. We saw it during the primary earlier in the year, and we knew that we needed more time to be able to have a timely count completed. Unfortunately, the lawsuit that the Republican Party put forward was successful in keeping us from being able to count any earlier than 7 a.m. on Election Day.
Right. Pennsylvania had showed Trump ahead of Biden because, of course, there was so much of a backlog of those early Democratic-heavy votes left to be counted. What have the Trump supporters been saying? Have you been talking to any of them? I would love to know, when they say stop counting the votes, what exactly do they mean?
Well, that's a great question. I have not spent my energy having conversations with them. Their commitment is to stop the vote. Our commitment is to make sure that every vote is counted. That has been our tagline. That remains to be our tagline. That's our motto and our creed. Count every single vote, every single solitary one of them. And they will be counted. I do know that there are those who suggest that somehow in a largely black and brown city, Philadelphia is the poorest city in the country, and also not by any coincidence, 51% of the population are people of color. 48 to 49% are black folks. And to be in a city like this, where there are those who are literally questioning the legitimacy, the validity of legitimately casted ballots, just harkens back to what we already know, the deep racism that is true to this country, and to those who think it's more important for us to appease the feelings of the current sitting president as opposed to honor the voice of the people. So I'm not quite sure what all the reasons are, but those are some of the things that we've been hinted to.
Let's go now to Georgia, where Anna Dennis is joining us from, and she is the executive director of Common Cause Georgia. Georgia, the state that might have had Governor Stacey Abrams as a Republican in charge. Georgia is also the place where the state where there could actually be a pathway for some very marginal Senate control for Democrats.
So in Georgia, Georgia is definitely on everyone's mind. We are uniquely positioned in this moment. And as being a Georgian, I never would have thought in the last 20 years that we would actually be here in this moment. But this is very monumental for Georgians and for progressives who are champions for democracy. I think the number is 4.2 million voters vote in this past election. 2 million of those voters actually requested a vote by mail ballot, and 1.5 million of those voters actually voted in person during early voting. So this cycle, we have seen our numbers really skyrocket in participation, but I think that is a testament to what happened in our gubernatorial race in 2018 and how so many people felt like their votes were disenfranchised and their votes wasn't counted. So with Common Cause Georgia, we are making sure that we can have every vote count, because that's what democracy needs, and that's what the Georgians here, that's what we want, and that's what we deserve, just to have a fair, equitable access to the ballot.
I want to turn back to Nicholas O'Rourke joining us from Philadelphia. Nicholas, what is the math in terms of how Pennsylvania has changed from 4 years ago? This is a critically important state for Democrats and Republicans. It's also you're also in a city that has been racked by police violence in recent days, and where the Black Lives Matter movement has been incredibly active. And I imagine that that's also playing a role and is on people's minds.
I think it's important to note that anytime that we mention what has happened recently, that we always mention the name of our fallen brother. Admiral Walt, his name is Walter Wallace Jr. We say his name. Just this past Monday, he was murdered at the hands of two police officers. His family called really for an ambulance. He was known to have a number of mental health challenges, and he was a danger to himself and to others. And they were needing some help, an ambulance, someone to come help him with the case. In less than 40 seconds upon officers arriving to the scene, they put, I counted, at least 10 to 15 bullets in his body and ended his life in front of his mother. And so in no small part is that playing into the spirit and the energy in this moment. We stand in solidarity with our comrades who are a part and organized with Black Lives Matter Philly, the Black Philly Radical Collective, and all others as well. And we've already put forward many demands, so several demands about what we want. The tapes were released recently. We're looking to make sure that there's no increased funding for the police department. We already have nearly a $1 billion budget here in Philadelphia, about $800 million or so. And we're asking for no increased funding for meaningless reforms. We need to make sure that the officers that have murdered Walter Wallace Jr. are fired immediately. And also we put mechanisms in place to be able to handle situations that are concerning mental health. This is the reason why so many have called for a divest invest model, what is properly known as defund the police, to make sure that we can actually invest into structures that are going to help support and bring about not just law enforcement, but actual public safety for our people. That having been said, what we did see in 2016 was Donald Trump win the Commonwealth of PA by 44,000, I think 242 votes. We know that's a small margin. When you look at a place like Philadelphia, which is the economic engine of the Commonwealth and the major part of the electoral block, how are you? You see that 40,000 votes is something that you can pull out of North Philadelphia or South Philadelphia alone if the people show up to vote. And so what we have found is that there's been a lot of work that myself and many others, a part of the Working Families Party, have done to help get increased voter turnout, because we know that the path to the White House and really any seat here in this city across the Commonwealth or as high as the federal courts or the federal office is through black communities, the same ones that are deeply impacted by what we just saw in the last week and other examples of police brutality and the carceral system that we see in this country. And so we have seen a major increase in voter turnout. That the swing voters aren't the only folks that are swinging back and forth between Democrat and Republicans. They're those who are quiet and either vote for someone that a Democrat they're inspired by or not voting at all. Well, this year they showed up and they're showing out. And we're looking to make sure that every single one of their votes are counted, because we believe it's going to render a result for Joe Biden.
There may be a lot of attention on Philadelphia. Are you hearing anything about whether the final vote counts are going to, which, as you said, Philadelphia is one of the last places left to count votes. Are you expecting that all to happen very soon?
Yeah, we believe that it should. To be clear, from the very beginning, we already knew that it was going to be a long time for us to be able to get votes counted, considering there was so much resistance to being able to count those votes prior to Election Day, the ones that we already had. So this is just playing out as we always understood. We needed a couple days, maybe even a couple weeks, depending on how voter turnout spanned out.
Some people were disappointed that Biden didn't have a complete blowout, but where the popular vote is concerned, he did have a complete blowout. It's just the Electoral College system is why we are sitting here waiting on tenterhooks for Pennsylvania's vote, right?
Absolutely. I think for quite literally, this is a blowout. We see that that soon-to-be President-elect Joe Biden has actually gotten more received more votes in the popular vote than, I guess, any other candidate in American history. And so that is any small win. That's a major victory. We believe that here in Pennsylvania, we're on track that once all the votes are done and over with, that he will win the Commonwealth, and we think he'll win by 70,000-80,000 votes.
Well, I want to thank you.
So we're looking forward to that.
Thank you so much, Nicholas. Good luck to you. Anna, last thoughts on those questions around the Senate races in Georgia?
Yes, so we are keeping a close eye when we finish the count.
Let's turn back to Georgia, where Anna Dennis is with us. The Senate races, I think, are important to discuss. So Georgia's two Republican senators, what are the chances, first of all, that both will end? Well, we know that one, Senator Loeffler is going to be in a runoff in January with the second race. Last I checked, Perdue, Senator Perdue was right at 50%, and Georgia's one of those strange states where you have to get at least 50% of the vote or you are in a runoff. What are the chances that both Senate races will have a runoff in January? And then if that does happen, what are the chances that the Democrats could actually pull off wins in both of them?
Yeah, so we are, you know, we're looking at most likely having two Senate races. And we know that the Reverend Warnock race is going to run off in January, and we're keeping a close eye on the other race as well. The margin is so small.
And I know, just for our audience, Anna Dennis's child is with her, as all working parents are now having their children with us. So that we'll just deal with it and continue. Go ahead.
We will know more if we're going to run off, but it looks like we're definitely going to go in a runoff. It'll definitely shift our Senate nationally.
And I'm actually looking right now, New York Times is saying David Perdue's vote share has fallen to 49.9%. So unless that changes, there will be a runoff.
Yep, we are going definitely to runoff. And then also making sure we get people back out to the polls on January 5th to make sure that all our ballots are counted.
Well, maybe we'll
wins in Georgia.
Maybe we'll have you back on in January. Then thank you all so much for joining us today. My guests have been Anna Dennis, Executive Director of Common Cause Georgia, and Nicholas O'Rourke, who is Pennsylvania Organizing Director of the Working Families Party, joining us from Philadelphia. I spoke with Nicholas and Anna on Thursday evening as the states of Pennsylvania and Georgia were turning from red to blue. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As the states of Arizona, Pennsylvania, and Georgia flip from red to blue in the presidential election, We turn our focus today on how working class communities of color put in the tremendous amount of effort to make this possible. The presumptive president-elect Joe Biden would likely not have won the margins in swing states that he did were it not for these crucial constituencies. My guest is Saru Jayaraman, president of One Fair Wage and assistant adjunct professor of public policy and director of the Food Labor Research Center at University of California, Berkeley. Welcome to the program, Saru.
Thanks for having me.
So let's first talk about Arizona. There were disappointments with Texas and Florida, but let's talk about Arizona. This was a state that even Fox News was the first to call it for Joe Biden. What can you tell us about the work that especially immigrant communities and immigrant families, immigrant backing families, new citizens did in turning that state from red to blue?
I mean, I think all of these last few states that have been really holdouts and that are shockingly turning blue are the result of, frankly, women of color organizers on the ground in not just Arizona, also Georgia, Pennsylvania. Our organization had women of color organizers on the ground doing some of this work in these states. Organizing low-wage workers, organizing working families, organizing communities that typically don't vote because, frankly, they have not in the past seen the Democratic Party really do anything for them. But talking to low-wage workers, working families, about the things that could change through organizing, not just, frankly, organizing to vote, but organizing for a different terrain on which to keep fighting. I mean, I think that's the thing that I think the Democratic Party has got wrong for so long. For so long, A, they don't even focus on communities of color. They don't focus on working people. But B, if it's all about vote, 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 and then they fail to address the needs of these communities after the election, these communities will see no reason to continue to vote. So for us, it was about organizing in Michigan and Pennsylvania. The same was true in Arizona. Communities organizing people to vote, again, not just to say, let's all go out and vote just because we should, but let's all go fight for a better future for ourselves. Let's go fight for a better terrain on which to fight. President Trump will not ever concede to raising the minimum wage or to immigration, the kind of immigration policy that we really need in this country for people to live with dignity and respect, or truly any kind of universal healthcare or healthcare for people, or climate change. So haven't been organizing people just to vote. We're organizing for a progressive future. And I think if the Democrats don't understand that, I've definitely heard, as everybody has, these comments that somehow this election, the lesson from this election is we've got to become more centrist. Somehow the way to unify the country is to move more to the center and stop talking about these radical ideas. When truly the people on the ground in Arizona, to answer your question, the reason why these states were won, the reason why ultimately Biden is likely to be our next president, the reason is because organizers were talking to communities about a progressive vision for the future and mobilizing people, again, not just to vote, but to keep organizing for that progressive future even after we vote. And it's that progressive vision that, frankly, most Americans believe in, agree with. In Florida, 66% of Floridians voted to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour at the same time that only about 52% voted for Trump.
Now, some people have pointed to Kara Eastman's loss in Florida. She was a progressive congressional candidate as a reason why progressive candidates can't win. And the fact that even though they voted for this $15 an hour minimum wage, it's because it didn't face much opposition because, frankly, it's a modest bill. It takes 5 years to get to 15. How do you miss one of them?
Oh my gosh, there's been tremendous opposition to raising the minimum wage. I know I'm in the center of it. I have been the center of attack for a lot of the restaurant association's opposition to raising the minimum wage. That's just ridiculous. Listen, there is still white supremacy and patriarchy in our country. That is undeniable. And it makes it harder for women of color, women in leadership to really you know, get the positions that sometimes they need to get. But the progressive values that so much of the country undeniably believes in are, I mean, the fact that that was voted on with such fervor, with such unanimous kind of consent, to me is an indication that ultimately we actually have to move away from the candidates and focus on these issues and really believe in the power of organizing and women of color who are leading organizing all around the country. It isn't just about the candidates.
Right.
It's about the organizers. It's about the organizing. That's what won Arizona. That's what's winning Georgia. That's what's winning Pennsylvania.
Looking at the sort of granular details of where votes were cast and where they're being counted, you see in states like Georgia and Pennsylvania, these seas of red because they're sparsely populated Republican areas, and then these giant, you know, these blue areas that are the densely populated cities where there are communities of color, in particular Black communities living, especially in, you know, Atlanta and in Philadelphia. Those are the places where I understand, from what I can tell, the tremendous amount of get out the vote campaigning and work on the ground to get Black voters to show up at the polls to overcome the roadblocks that Republican state legislatures put in front of them has made a huge difference. Those were the votes that were being counted Thursday night that the whole nation was watching.
That's right. But I want to reiterate, this work to get people out to vote is not just about voting.
Yeah.
It is about a different future. It is about rejecting the last 4 years and frankly rejecting what was there before that, rejecting a neoliberal agenda that was not taking care of the majority of working Americans, that was not really thinking about the kind of policies that people truly want. So the organizing was not just to vote. It was about this vision for a different future. And the Democrats have to deliver on that future, not just celebrate the election and then take a back seat or think that now we move to the center and we try to please the right. I mean, just to what you just said, if it came down to communities of color in Philadelphia and Atlanta and Phoenix, then we've got to deliver for those communities. We've got to not only deliver for those communities, but we've got to inspire people with our ability to create change, to not go back to the way things were, but to envision a totally different future. That is what will keep people voting. That is what will allow this huge historic turnout to continue into the next cycle.
Do you think that presumptive president-elect Joe Biden is hearing this? Because right now, of course, there are 1,000,001 people whispering into his ear, screaming into his ear. Perhaps among them are the center of the Democratic Party, where he is comfortable, because that's where he comes from. And then there are people at the grassroots who may not directly have his ear, but who are shouting as loud as they can for him to hear that they need to be rewarded for the hard work they've done. They want their policies at the front of his agenda. Is Biden up to the task? I mean, his VP Kamala Harris may look the part, but she too is from, I would say, the center left maybe of the Democratic Party.
Listen, we already know it's possible because they moved to the left during the campaign.
Yeah.
The policies and their platform that they put forward was a progressive, bold vision. And that is how it made it possible for organizers on the ground like us to actually inspire people and excite people who hadn't voted before to believe that if I vote this time, it actually might make a difference.
And of course, the centrists will argue that had Biden played to the center, the vote margin would have been bigger. But I mean, there's no really evidence to show that, because this is the discussion. This is the fight that takes place, the ideological battle between center and left that takes place every 4 years and in between.
I would just point to two things. Ultimately, who delivered in Arizona, in Georgia, in Pennsylvania? Who delivered in states that Hillary Clinton lost in 2016? Who flipped those states? It was communities of color, it was organizers, it was women of color. Yes, thrilled that there was a more progressive platform to work with to inspire people. So I think it has to be, the evidence is clear. Who inspired more people to vote? A centrist agenda in 2016 or a progressive platform truly fueled by women of color organizers that were able to ultimately flip states that nobody else could flip? That evidence is clear. And then if you look at Florida and you look at the minimum wage, to me, that evidence is also crystal clear that frankly, the divided nation and the 45% was, I think, because we weren't bold enough, because we weren't proud enough, because we weren't loud enough about the need for these universally progressive policies.
Right, that agenda was there on Biden's campaign platform. He wasn't speaking about it as loudly as he could have, but it was there for organizers to point to excite voters, but it would have been potentially better for him. And then you do have to contend with that section of the electorate that sees any Democrat as socialist, that sees any hint toward government, a role for the government as the socialist bogeyman. And unfortunately, Republicans are quite good at convincing some in, say, Latino communities to buy that.
You know, I think there's such misunderstanding of that word and what it means and the way that Republicans are using it as a...
And then is the task then for progressives to try to explain what that means better?
No, the task is to be very clear about the policies that we are talking about. When you talk about raising the minimum wage, when you talk about healthcare that everybody can access, when you talk about the need to address climate change in Florida, when you're very clear about those things and unapologetic, people get it. When you start to use words that are rhetoric or you're reacting to the rights, you know, you're saying, no, we're not that. Every time you say, no, we're not that, it affirms what they said you are. So instead of saying, no, we're not that, we say we are about raising the wage to $15 an hour. We are about universal healthcare, everybody having the ability to go get healthcare. We are about absolutely addressing climate change and reproductive justice. Because if Biden had made a big deal in Florida of that $15 minimum wage, a lot of those people who voted, 66% who voted to raise the minimum wage to $15, would connect Biden to what they really believed in. And that's what we've been missing. I will say again, we saw and we were very appreciative of Biden and Harris moving the platform to the left during the campaign based on the amazing organizing of so many people across the country, having a platform that we could work with. But I think it will only help them going into the administration to actually live into that agenda unapologetically rather than moving to the center.
And we should also remind ourselves that there's this battle within the Democratic Party, but panning back and looking at it from the broad view, you had President Trump and his allies saying that they wanted to stop the vote counting before the Black and brown heavy districts votes were counted. I mean, they literally have tried so hard to stop the votes of people of color. They've tried to, you know, make it difficult for them to access the polls. And this year, once the votes were cast, they tried to stop the votes from being counted, because when they were chanting, stop the vote, stop the count, stop the steal, what they were basically saying was, Philadelphia, Atlanta, Phoenix, all of those those densely populated cities where communities of color live, their votes don't count. They're literally telling people that.
When they are saying those votes are illegitimate, those votes are illegal, they are saying those people are illegitimate. Those people don't have a right, the same right as they do, to have a voice in this country. And this is why, rather than moving to the center or pandering, what we need to be doing is actually mobilizing our people to say, absolutely, our voices will be heard, our votes will be counted, and our voices need to be heard not just in this election, not just to make Biden president, but frankly, they need to be heard in a Biden administration. Mm. We need to continue to mobilize. It's on us. We hopefully have learned our lesson from the Obama years. We can't be thrilled about getting Trump out of office and then step back and breathe a sigh of relief and say it's over, everything's going to be okay. We have to mobilize our people to demand that our voices be heard, to demand that the people that got him into office in these swing states are the ones that are listened to, that their needs are addressed, that their wages go up, that they get health care, that they get all the things that they need.
Finally, Saru, you are in California like I am. What happened with some of the propositions that had the flood of corporate money? Is California's proposition system broken because it's just far too susceptible to the unlimited buckets of money that companies like Uber and, you know, Wall Street hedge fund managers that own property in the state do?
I was very, very disappointing. And it just, again, pointed to, as you said, that with money, you can essentially confuse the electorate, completely, you know, disinform, spread a campaign of misinformation and disinformation.
Using that language that progressives use, I should add.
Created packs called Feel the Burn for Proposition 22, or Progressive Latinos and Blacks for Proposition 22.
And the NAACP seems to have lost all credibility in California, the California chapter of it.
A campaign of misinformation funded by corporations. Absolutely, we need to think about a different system. When corporations can pour $170, $200, $300 million into misinforming the public, because I know Californians would never have voted for Proposition 22 if they understood what it really meant for drivers.
This is the gig worker economy proposition.
Right. I mean, this proposition is so harmful, it will result in these workers earning less than the minimum wage, getting a sub-minimum wage. It already has resulted in these workers having no access to unemployment insurance during a horrible recession and pandemic. It's devastating for millions of people. And I know Californians, had they not been misled, would not have voted for that. I know Californians generally agree with Prop 15, but they were so misled. I think it's time definitely for a different system in which there are limits on how much both sides can spend in misinforming or disinforming the public.
You would have thought that we would have learned from Proposition 8, the anti-same-sex, anti-same-sex marriage ballot initiative that narrowly won years ago because the population was misled into voting against same-sex marriage, and then we ended up overturning it through the courts, and certainly in a state like California. Yeah,
that's right. That does give you hope, though. It gives you hope that knowing that people were misled, we can correct the harm, and we have to do that now in California. Mm-hmm. We have to correct the harm. We have to be a harbinger for the nation of progressive policies that take care of people. And I mean, again, California is another proof point. When you actually deliver progressive policies, the state flips, as we're seeing with Arizona and Georgia and Pennsylvania. So let California be an example for the rest of the country, not one that regresses backwards, but one that really shows the path forward.
Saru, thank you so much, as always, for joining us today. Really appreciate having you on.
Thank you.
My guest has been Saru Jayaraman, president of One Fair Wage, assistant adjunct professor of public policy and director of the Food Labor Research Center at UC Berkeley. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As presumptive President-elect Joe Biden starts crafting his first-term agenda, choosing key appointments, we'll turn today to the conversation of what's next for progressive movements in the nation. On Friday morning, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called Biden a great unifier.
I wish we weren't wearing masks so we could see how exciting it is to come before you today with Joe Biden having the tremendous mandate that he has, and that pretty soon the hyphen will be gone from vice president to President-elect Joe Biden. It's a happy day for our country because Joe Biden is a unifier, because he is determined to bring people together, because he respects all points of view, and as he has said, I ran as a Democrat, I'll govern as president for all of the people, whether they voted for me or not.
That's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on Friday morning. The presidential race is not officially over, but a new chapter in the battle within the Democratic Party is already starting. My guest is Sarah Van Gelder, activist, speaker, and author of The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile journey through a New America. She's also co-founder of People's Hub and Yes Magazine. Welcome to the program, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Nancy Pelosi saying that Joe Biden is a unifier, that he ran as a Democrat but will govern as president of all people. How important is it for this to be made clear at a time when there really is truly a lot of divisiveness and division within the American people? 60 to 70 million people did vote for President Trump, and he made it clear that he wanted to govern as a Republican and basically for Republicans, that if you were a conservative Trump supporting Republican, you would be favored by him, and if you weren't, forget about it. And Joe Biden is coming and saying, I'm not going to do that. That is important, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the American people have been suffering tremendously under the Trump regime. I think an awful lot of the things that Americans really want, like secure healthcare, like an end to this pandemic, like secure jobs, those things have not been happening. And I think Trump has done a really good job of throwing a lot of smoke screens up that trigger really reactive kinds of responses, and that's been able to shield from view just how much damage he's been causing. But I think now the big opportunity we have is to move forward with real conversations about things that people really care about and that really matter. I mean, for once, we won't be talking about whether climate change is real and whether we should withdraw from the climate agreement, which we, of course, just did under Trump. We can talk about how to solve the problem and how to do it in a way that can give everyone a chance to thrive, whether that's a laid off steel worker in Ohio or whether that's a person in Philadelphia. You know, everyone really needs an opportunity to have a good, well-paying job that's secure and that is not destroying the planet.
Now, the President-elect Joe Biden, or presumptive President-elect might be the more accurate way of saying it, did say that when the U.S. officially left the Paris Accord, that in 77 days, if and when he's president, he will return the U.S. back into that accord, which is, of course, a good thing for climate justice activists. But we also knew that the Paris Accord was the baseline for where to start on addressing climate change. And while Biden has made it clear that he wants to be strong on the climate, the question is, will he be strong enough? I mean, compared to Trump, when we're starting with a baseline of Trump, almost anything is better. But of course, should we settle for almost anything?
Well, clearly the planet can't afford for us to settle for anything, just anything. There is no pause in the ways in which the biochemistry of the planet is continuing to deteriorate. So we don't have the the luxury of waiting on this question. We have to move forward. The good news is that the best way to move forward on the climate is also the best way to deal with our economic crisis. All the kinds of jobs, and Joe Biden did do a good job talking about the kinds of jobs that are created when you actually make the transition to a renewable economy, to an economy based on not fossil fuels, but renewable sources of energy. There's a lot more that may take some real pressure on him to go as far as is actually required. And luckily, we have enormous new movements, especially built on the work of young people, the Sunrise Movement and the We Count Movement. I mean, there are young people who are just all over this issue and just doing it with real vision and real energy, and I'm very hopeful that movement is going to help keep things moving forward, whether or not Joe Biden is leading or following.
So the appointments to key positions is a big part of where a future President Biden would make a difference. We know from the past, however, of course, that centrist Democrats like Biden are not to be trusted, and they often walk into dynamics, walk into spaces where they have to cooperate with Republicans with this dynamic of, you know, let's work and reach across the aisle, let's embrace one another. And you can't really do that with the Republican Party, because the Republican Party has made very clear they don't fight fair, they fight dirty. And so if Biden comes in and leaves in place, you know, even a few of Trump's appointees, and Trump's appointees are even worse than, say, George W. Bush's appointees, because they're so much more politicized. If Biden comes in and doesn't do a clean sweep, we're in big trouble, right?
I think that's true. I think it's important to make a distinction between Republicans at the national level, who have just become completely corrupted by the lies and the racism and the misogyny and everything else of the Trump administration. I mean, I honestly don't know how they can hold their heads up with any kind of self-respect in public. And the Republicans at the local level, and I think there are all kinds of Republicans at the local level, including people with a lot of integrity. So I think one thing that's really important is that we can't just throw, you know, 40% of the American public under the bus and say, oh, we don't want to deal with you. 40% of the American public may have been misled and may be struggling to come to terms with the reality that we are a multiracial society and that women have rights and so forth. And we're just going to have to do our best to continue to bring them along. And I believe that work happens best at the local level. But coming back to your question, we absolutely need to have progressives running things. We need to have people with real vision of how we move forward. We need to have people in positions of authority who are courageous and are willing to do the kind of work that actually needs to be done given the difficult challenges that we're facing right now, whether it's on climate or whether it's making sure everybody has healthcare coverage and that we don't have people going bankrupt because even though they are covered, the insurance system is so full of holes. I mean, we have some really serious questions that need to be addressed right now, and that will take real leadership. Now, as you know, Mitch McConnell has said he's not going to allow any so-called radical appointees to make it through his Senate. We still have the possibility, I don't know how likely it is, we still have the possibility that the Senate could be divided half and half with Kamala Harris casting the tie-breaking vote.
And that is if the two Georgia Senate races that are set to take place early January, if they both go in the direction of Democrats, which is going to be an uphill battle, but Georgia is changing, so we'll see.
It's changing, and it's changing a lot because of the work of Stacey Abrams and the extraordinary coalition that she's put together. I mean, I just think it's really important, and I think that the Democratic Party at a national level often loses track of this. It's really important to acknowledge just the powerful and profoundly visionary work that's been happening on the ground in some key states, including Georgia, and how important it has been to have people of color like Stacey Abrams, especially women of color, leading these kinds of efforts. It's just been extraordinarily powerful.
Now, even though Biden's task, the bigger task might be to bring together all Americans, conservatives and liberals, within the Democratic Party, his task, and really Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer's task, is to bring together the progressive and centrist parts of the Democratic Party, right? I mean, it's unfortunately far too often that the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warrens, and AOCs are shoved aside when it comes to key positions in a Democratic administration. For one thing, Biden could revive the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau and maybe put Elizabeth, you know, task Senator Elizabeth Warren with helping to do that. She, of course, was the first head of this CFPB. Those are the sorts of things, you know, so people have talked about Sanders as a labor secretary. Of course, we don't want to lose their seats in the Senate, but a Sanders-like person as labor secretary, all of those things are possible and should be considered.
Absolutely. And one of the good signs is that Biden did bring in a lot of the Sanders team to help him work on his platform and really actually did seem to listen. So that's a good sign. On the other hand, we know what kind of pressure he'll be on from the right, from Wall Street bankers and from large corporations to do the things that benefit them. And so it will be really important to, you know, even as we take a deep breath and celebrate what we believe will be a victory, that we don't let up, that the organizing that has been done on the ground to win this election, that organizing continue, and that Biden continue to hear from us and our state, our national representatives, as well as the state reps, that they continue to hear from us about the things that matter to us. Because when, as some of our favorite organizers say, when we fight, we win. You know, when we say we want healthcare where everybody is covered, you know, we're gonna get that. So, and the same with taxes. The majority of the American people are in favor, almost two-thirds of Americans are in favor of a tax on the wealthiest.
I want to pick up on what happened on Thursday within the Democratic Party. The Washington Post reported in an article entitled "Centrist House Democrats Lash Out at Liberal Colleagues Blaming Far-Left Views for Costing the Party Seats." And in particular, Representative Abigail Spanberger, a Democrat from Virginia, who narrowly leads in her re-election bid, said, "We need not ever use the word socialist or socialism ever again. We lost good members because of that. If we're classifying Tuesday as a success, we will get effing torn apart in 2022. She cited the progressives within the party as being the reason why the Democrats lost some House seats and narrowed their majority. And I'm assuming she also blames that for why Democrats didn't win control of the Senate. How do you respond to that?
Well, first, I'd say we have to do a lot of analyzing of data and of exit polls before we try to jump to any conclusions. I don't have any doubt that there are specific seats that may have gone the way she suggested. So that could be the case. But I also think you need to remember just how much energy people like Bernie Sanders and people like Elizabeth Warren were able to generate among people who were willing to go to the polls, you know, and organize and get their friends out. You know, there's a tremendous amount of energy behind the kind of progressive agenda that can actually make a difference in people's lives. And if that gets compromised away, I think there's a real danger of us going down the same path that I think the Hillary Clinton candidacy represented.
And also, just briefly, what happens when you have narrow majorities in the House and the Senate is then you have these conservative Democrats that end up being kingmakers in terms of legislation.
That's right. And that's, again, why we need to be, we the people need to stay active. We can't afford to do what we did in the first years of the President Obama administration, which was to basically say, oh, good, well, our guy's in and now let's relax and do other things with our lives. We can't afford that. We are going to have to stay just as active throughout this process.
And we are exhausted, but, you know, maybe spend a day relaxing and get back to work.
Absolutely. Self-care is so important as taking a break from the work, but I also think it's really important that we do it as part of our work, that we really support each other, that we really love on each other, that we really lift each other up and just celebrate the kinds of grassroots leaders that are willing to do that kind of hard work. Just keep on celebrating them. Even when they make mistakes, it's okay to say, you know what, I would do it differently, but I so appreciate you being willing to stand up. We just have to learn to do that really well, to just love on each other.
Should healthcare be top of a President Biden's agenda? You know, he has been a better leader on the coronavirus pandemic than Trump. But then again, anybody would be a better leader. He has taken it seriously. He has called for a national mask mandate. But a national mask mandate is one thing. A national healthcare program is another thing. This is the perfect opportunity. I can't imagine the nation being against a national healthcare program in January with the coronavirus raging. Even a Fox News exit poll showed 74% of people coming out of one voting booth, I wish I could remember where it was, said that the government should run the healthcare system.
Clearly, that's so necessary right now, and was always necessary. And by the way, a majority of Americans have supported this for years, and you haven't seen that in the Democratic debate. The establishment within the Democratic Party has just succeeded. I've been covering this as a journalist for years, and they've succeeded in literally excluding people from the room when the conversation happens if they're advocates of Medicare for all. So, and thank you to Bernie Sanders for just really pushing that issue. I think he did an amazing job. And I think, you know, majority of Americans are now clear on using that language and what needs to happen. So whether Biden will you know, be able to stand up to the pressure of the insurance industry and all the people who are making tons of money off of this healthcare system, I don't know. I think he's promised a public option. That would be a good step in the right direction. But, you know, the people who say that Obamacare is not a big success, I agree with them. It's better than what there was before.
And it was Obamacare's weaknesses that have opened it up to being attacked from the right, unfortunately.
I agree with that.
Yeah. The most strongest part of it, which was the ending discrimination against people with pre-existing conditions, is something that even Republicans can't touch anymore. Well, I want to thank you so much, Sarah, for joining us today, and we'll probably see you in the new year.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Sarah Van Gelder, activist, speaker, and author of The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-Mile Journey Through a New America. She's also the co-founder of People's Hub and Yes Magazine. We've been discussing where progressive movements go under a future Biden presidency. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kolhatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band, Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
In the 1980s, Portland, Oregon was a sleepy city that largely